Italy looking absolutely superficial, sort of like this. And I thought, that's not, if that's all he can get from this book, I have to reread it. And I realized after reading it that I needed to do a lot of work. So I did a completely new book, and I've called it Do It Well. Well, anyway, that book was... Barnes & Noble is the biggest chain in America, and they wanted to have a copy to put as a special edition on their, on some special table of theirs. I don't know what it is. Anyway, I had to work for a deadline, timeline, and I worked hard and I got it to them. But after I had finished it, I thought, well, I'd like to just go over it once or twice to see if maybe now that I don't have a timeline, my I have the time to correct it, I will do a better job. Since then, I have done 15 editing. I've gone through it 15 times. This is a difficult book because there are 366 essays in one paragraph. Each paragraph, one essay. So it's not like one long text. You have to switch gears every time you come to a new thing. So it's been a difficult book to write. I think it may be a wonderful book. I think it's possibly a horrible book. I just don't know. Anyway, I thought I might read it to you, but I'm not going to do the TV show today because, at least this morning, because I don't feel up to it. After that nosebleed and working so hard, I really don't feel I could do justice to that. I could, but at the expense of my body, and I just don't think I should. You know, I think that maybe I'm slightly crazy. I mean, anybody in his right mind at the age of 84 usually rests. He figures he ought to take time out now, but I'm working harder than I ever did. And that's what I say. I don't think I'm quite right in the head. Anyway, first I would like to ask you if you have any questions, because I'm not going to do the show, but I'm so happy to have you here. And it really has been for me a great joy to have you. Thank you for coming. So do you have any questions?
Swamiji, in Gita, at one place Krishna says that I am all that is. And at another place he says that I am not the doer. So there is contradiction. Well, at one place in 9th chapter he says I am not the doer. But in another place he says, I'm the everything whatsoever I've been done. So I'm the creator.
He tells Arjuna to say, I'm not the doer. But okay, we can put it this way, that God doesn't do, although he does do. Their truth is always and delightfully full of contradictions. And you have to understand those contradictions, because he has no I. And even though acting, he says, I don't act. Because that action itself is maya, it's a delusion. So although he seems to be acting, and he has this wave of maya which creates the appearances of the universe and so on, yet he isn't doing it himself, it's not being done, it's all a dream. And am I making something absolutely muddy a little clearer, or am I making it muddier? You know, we don't need to really understand questions like that, because what we need to know is what comes next for me. What do I do now? And that's why I find that many times the first question people ask is, what is the difference between Sabhikalpa and Nirvikalpa Samadhi? My answer to that is, wait till you get there. You're new on the path, there are other things a lot more urgent to ask about. Any questions? Somebody could sit, you could sit here.
How does one know when to give up one's staff responsibility towards one's parents?
How does one know when to give up one's dharmic responsibility towards one's parents to be on the path?
You never should give up that responsibility. You should always honor and take care of them. But if they try to take you from the path, That's a different thing. They're acting out dharmically then. It is in the shastras, it says, if a lower duty conflicts with a higher duty, it ceases to be a duty. But all things considered, you owe it to your parents to take care of them. They took care of you. And so, in general, that is my answer. In particular, I would have to know the case. Okay?
I think she was also asking regarding taking vows of renunciation.
You know, I talked to the Jagadguru Shankaracharya of Gowardhan Math in Puri on this question. And he said, you don't have to forsake your family. You have to understand that your family is the whole world. So why reject one part of it to embrace the whole world? Everything is a part of the same reality. So you should still love your parents and love everybody, but as a part of all, as children of God. So there isn't that ego there that says these are mine. Unless you say everybody is mine in God, that's okay. What we're trying to do, and the whole secret of spiritual success, is to get rid of this ego. And one thing that keeps us bound are all the little attachments. My pride of pedigree is one of them. And the thought that this family is mine, this house is mine, etc. So these things we have to give up. It's in this sense, well, they say that there's a saying, I love humanity, it's people I can't stand. What we need to do is understand that all humanity is people. We can't just love them as if they were sort of a mystical cloud out there. We have to see them. God is in them. So we have to love that God in all of them. If we can't make our religion practical, then we haven't lived it properly. So much of the spiritual path is trying to see how we can make my religion work for me. And, okay?
Yes. Along those same lines, Swamiji, I feel like there's probably a difference of opinion between parents and what they want from their children, and what they think is dharmic, and what the children feel is enough.
Well, I certainly had that problem. My father wanted me to be an electrical engineer, and I completely shocked him. One time my guru's father tried to talk against Sri Yukteswar, master set up all things. Physical birth is something, spiritual birth is everything. If I hear you say one more word against my guru, I renounce you as my father. And I had to say to my father once, I wrote to him a letter, and I said, you are my father for this life, God is my father for eternity, please don't make me choose. I love you as my earthly father, but if you force me to choose, I have to choose God. So please don't force that choice on me. So from then on, he kept a closed mouth. But if we have to make that choice, then that choice is the dharmic one, is more toward God. But people make a mistake in trying to force their children to be what they want to be. Every child comes into this world with his own life to live. And parents have a certain duty to them, but they are not there to satisfy their parents' ambitions. Each person comes in to advance his own karmic needs, to get rid of the karmic blocks and so on. And it's a kind of tyranny to think that to make your children be what you want them to be. There are a lot of parents who do that. It's not right. I know that in India it's even more strong because they have this caste system. But the true caste system of the ancient times was not hereditary. And your father could be a Brahmin and you could be a Shudra, or vice versa. It was not meant to be. Come on in. It was not meant to be that whatever your family is, that's what you are. Usually it is so, but it is not necessarily. When there's room here, Over here. There you go. Over there, okay. As a fond parent, I say, there, no, no. So, what was I saying? Is that it?
The caste system.
Yeah, that the caste system is meant, originally it was meant to help people to know the direction to grow. For example, you're a Vaishya, and if you want to keep being a Vaishya, you can have this kind of business, that kind of business, all kinds. But if you want to grow spiritually, then you have to grow toward using what you have to help other people. And in that way, to grow toward becoming a Kshatriya. And this direction of growth is universal. Actually, the four castes are the four races of man. The true races of man are not the color of a person's skin. They are the basic temperaments of people. And you will see that an accountant in New York and an accountant in Pune will have more in common with each other, will understand each other better, will have more to say to each other than to their next door neighbors. So it depends on where your consciousness is. That is what determines your caste, that is what determines your race and your division in the human race. Questions? Please help me out. Yeah.
Actually,
you have to talk loudly.
Over and over again, that to grow spiritually, you should release all your attachments.
To grow spiritually, you should release all your attachments.
You should love without being attached.
You should love without attachment.
But when it comes to your children, it's really very difficult.
But when it comes to your children, it's really very difficult.
Yes, it is difficult. Of course it's difficult. It's so for your husband, your wife, your parents and everything, but probably with your children it's the strongest. And yet, that very attachment can hinder their growth. When you are attached to your children, you want them to be so-and-so. There was a famous violinist in the West. He was called Fritz Kreisler, and he gained his fame in America, but his mother and father were Austrian. And he said, if I had not left my mother and come to America, I would not have become Fritz Kreisler. And Master often quoted that, because he had to leave home to become himself. Children who live too close to their families often can't become themselves. They've always got their parents as saying, sort of telling them what they ought to be. So it's an attachment for sure, but I think the best thing to do is always respect their individuality. A child is, it's not your child. He came there into this body, into this family, as a temporary stopping place. There was a little girl about 9 years old in Palo Alto who once said to me, "How old are you?" And I said, "When I was your age," I said, let's put it this way, "when I was your age, you were an old woman." So I didn't want to tell her I'm an old man. I put it that way. It's really an amazing thing, because we've been, you know how old you really are? You are as old as God. You have no other age. He's the one who, you are a part of Him. You can't help being that age. So yet, each time you come into this little baby body, it looks so helpless, but there was one baby that some mother gave to my guru. He said he nearly dropped it. He said he realized that he saw that it was the soul of a murderer. But it was a little baby. God gives us a chance every new lifetime to forget the past and start anew. So if you've had bad habits in the past, having a new lifetime gives you a chance to change. if you have been a murderer, you have a new chance so that you don't have that hypnosis that I am a murderer, and it may be possible to change. And it's a good thing also to think that every day is a new incarnation. It gives you a new chance to decide what you want to do from now on. Every breath, Lahiri Maharshi said, is in a sense a death and a reincarnation. When you exhale, you die. When you inhale, you are reborn. So that with every inhalation, you can use it as an opportunity to affirm a new reality. And you can actually change yourself to an amazing degree in this way, that you don't have to be who you think you are. You are really, anyway, a child of God and nothing else. And if you determine that you don't want to be selfish, you don't want to be greedy, you don't want to be proud, you don't want to have all these things, you can change them. And there was one story I read about an alcoholic, and he gave up drinking, and for 5 years he didn't drink, but he didn't throw his liquor away. And one day he slipped and he began drinking again. And suddenly he became so angry with himself, he went to that cupboard and took all those bottles and threw them on the sidewalk outside his home and broke every bottle. And the intensity with which he completely rejected that freed him forever. So with intensity you can change yourself. And I have sometimes with great intensity affirmed something and it ceased to be a problem for me. Master said to me that habits are only a concentration of the mind. You're concentrating one way, concentrate another way, and the habit will change. Most people can't do it quickly, but I want to tell you all this because it doesn't seem possible often. When you have a bad habit, it seems like you'll never get rid of it. You'll never get rid of the attachment, the attraction. And the truth is that once you're out of a delusion, whatever delusion it may be, when you're out of it, you just wondered how you ever got into it. It just has no reality for you. And so whatever faults you have, don't feel that this is who you are. We are really bundles of self-definition. That's about the best definition I can come up with. That we think we're American, we think we're Indian, we think we're women or men, we think we're rich or poor, we think we drink or don't drink, have a good sense of humor or don't have a good sense of humor. All these self-definitions that we pile on ourselves, what we need to do is get rid of them. And each time you've gotten rid of one self-definition, you're a lighter person. But they all become like a lot of luggage, which is difficult to carry, obstructive when you want to walk, and it's a great help to say that I'm not any of those things. And it's not easy to say you're not something. It's much easier to say that you are something. In other words, as that man came to a guru and asked for a technique, and the guru told him to do a certain technique. But just as the man was leaving the room, the guru said, "One thing I have to tell you, don't think about monkeys." Well, the man got home and the first thing he thought of was, "I must think about monkeys." And he thought of all the monkeys he could possibly imagine. He went to the encyclopedia and looked up different kinds of monkeys in Africa and in South America and so on. Finally, he came back to the guru. He said, "Take your technique. It's only made me monkey conscious." And so what we need to do is get rid of the false definitions, yes, but it's easier to concentrate on the positive side. Don't think, I am not angry. Rather think, I am calm. Don't think, I am not selfish. Think rather, I enjoy giving away to people. Instead of getting rid of old self-definitions, it would help to develop new good self-definitions. To develop an attitude of generosity, for example. I remember when I was 21, I used to smoke. I remember how I got into smoking. I was at a party and some girl gave me a cigarette and told me to inhale it. The first time I tried, I just thought I'd die of sickness. It was horrible. And so I told myself, I'm going to overcome this if it kills me. What was I trying to overcome? My aversion to smoking. Far better to overcome the interest in smoking. So I was pretty stupid. Anyway, I developed a certain habit of smoking, and then I decided after some years at the age of 21 that I didn't begin smoking that early, so it was not long that I had that habit. But at the age of 21, I decided I was going to be a hermit. And I thought, well, how am I going to be able to afford cigarettes if I'm a hermit? And besides, whoever heard of a hermit who smokes? Well, I didn't know anything about hermits anyway, but the thing is that I decided I had to give up smoking. Well, like Mark Twain, who said that smoking's the easiest habit in the world to give up, I've done it 1,000 times. I was just like him. I would give it up in the morning, and then at lunchtime I would think how nice a cigarette would be. And I'd give it up in the evening, in the morning I would think, gee, with my coffee this morning it would be so nice. And so I'd give it up and go back to it, and give it up and go back to it. And one blessing I had was a right understanding. And I never told myself, every time I went back to smoking, I never told myself I failed. I always said I have not yet succeeded. Now that's a very important thing for overcoming habits, because the tendency of many minds is to think, if you go back to it, think, oh, I'm no good, I'm a failure, I can't do this, I can't get it right. But every time I said, I have not yet succeeded, I found my mind becoming stronger and stronger, until after a little less than a year, or about a year, I remember I was living with four other young men at the time, and one of them came in my bedroom, and I said to him, well, I'm giving up smoking. I've heard that one before. I said, no, I mean it. And the next morning I woke up, I had no desire for cigarettes, and I kept a half-empty packet in my pocket for 2 weeks, giving it out to friends. I had no desire for it. The only thing is that one time, 2 months later, I dreamed that I'd smoked, but I didn't smoke. And then my father, who also had given up smoking, I dreamed that he smoked too, and I felt very badly for him. Anyway, these are the vagaries of the mind, but that absolute saying, I have not yet succeeded, brought me to the point where I had the strength to say it and made it really mean it. I've never really had a desire since then. So that's a good way. Any other questions?
Swamiji, you have mentioned that India and America in future have an important role together to play in the further evolution of humankind. Can you please say it more like
this? You have mentioned that India and America have an important role to play together in the future of mankind. Can you please say more about that?
America, of all countries, has perfected, as far as it can be perfected in this age, material efficiency. India, in its ancient tradition, has what my guru put it, it was just to put the words together properly, but it's more than efficiency, but he said India has developed spiritual efficiency. And in the future, in Dwapara Yuga, the ideal for mankind will be a combination of inner and outer ability to function well. I remember when I was here in India the first time, I came in 58, and I very soon saw, it was a more spiritual country then. I met saints, I haven't met saints since then really, but I did feel that they had a great need to come up to take their rightful place in the world. The teaching of Mahatma Gandhi, who wanted to go back to medieval times, that was not realistic. You can't turn back the clock. This is the new age we live in. We may regret that we are so materialistic, but we can't avoid the fact that we are. Therefore, we have to know how to handle it. And so I used to think that perhaps the best thing for India would be to have very cheap cars so that every secretary could buy one, because then they would have to build highways, and with good highways the towns and villages would have to have close contact with each other. They wouldn't all be cut off from one another. This would become a one country instead of all divided into so many little tiny segments. So I realized that India has to go through that phase. It has to claim its rightful place among the great nations of the world. And I remember Abdul Kalam, I visited him once, a friend took me, and he asked me, "What do you think of India today?" And I said, "It's going through a phase that it has to go through. It will not get away from its spirituality. There is something in the soil that keeps Indians. You can't get away from it. Every country has its own particular dharma, its own particular bhava." And he said that America and India would unite, not politically, but to lead the world on the path of righteousness. That India would be the guru of the world, the spiritual guru, and America would be the material guru. But these are still for the future. America right now is falling into a great depression and dragging the whole world down with it. And we will go through much suffering for a while. And there will be warfare and there will be massive destruction. And from 6 billion people, we may have less than 1 billion when it's all over. That I predict as a probability. However, I say also that that will change, that we're coming up into a higher yuga, and people will be much more, this will be a wonderful world after all this smoke has gone away and dust has settled. It will have, no, Master said there would be peace for 300 years. People would be so sick of fighting that they just wouldn't even think of it for 300 years. There would be peace all over the world and prosperity. But in the meantime, we're facing difficult times. There's even the possibility, and I've read the prophecy. I think it's possible. You know, several people have said, Padre Pio was a great saint in Italy. He said there would be 3 days of darkness. Somebody said, but I have not read it myself, that Yogananda also said there would be 3 days of darkness. And assuming that they were giving a true prediction, I've asked myself how that would come. I could only think of something hitting the planet so hard that for a while it stops moving, and then gradually its inner momentum would start the rotation again. I don't know if that would happen. If it does happen, if there were 3 days of night in the west, there would be 3 days of light here in the east. And India, with 3 days of sunshine, become intolerable. It would be... I know one time I was with Master. I was in the church, in the congregation, when he was teaching on Sunday. And he paused in the middle of his conversation, which is talking about the future anyway. It's not as if he was saying all is Brahma and then talking about this. But he said, "You don't know what a terrible cataclysm is coming." What a cataclysm usually means something not man-made. It means more than a depression. It means more than warfare. It could mean earthquakes, but terrible cataclysm. I don't know. One thing does fit that bill, that a comet would hit the world, or an asteroid or something, and have a great impact. I believe that we are headed for some great trial, and it won't be very long. I think so. Anyway, you don't have to worry too much about it. You've left your body so many times, and this world is really a kind of concentration camp, where instead of dying one by one as they die in normal society, everybody dies at once. What does it really matter? In 100 years there won't be anybody living who's on earth today. So, you know, even if you die in a great catastrophe, once you're out of your body, you don't feel pain. There's only release and a feeling of freedom. So don't have fear about these things. Fear is all man-made, it's mind-made. There's nothing to be afraid of. Everything in the end is bliss. And when you come out of it, but I have read, and there are fascinating books on the subject, on people. There's one by a man called James von Prague called Ghosts Among Us. But he's not speaking of ghosts as sort of something to be afraid of. It's just he has the ability to see people out of the body as well as in the body. And he sees that people are just the same. You don't change after you leave your physical body. You certainly don't suddenly become an angel, unless you are an angel already. But you are what you are, and you remain what you are. And whatever kind of person you have, you have the same personality, the same sense of humor, the same negativity or positivity. Everything is the same. You're entirely the same person. And you're on another, more subtle world. Usually people don't stay there very long, but if they've, according to their karma, I know that if you've been very generous to people and helped people, you stay in the astral world a long time. One who is a yogi realizes that the astral world is by no means a decent place to go to. If you want God, you should have no desire for the astral world. It is much more beautiful than this world, but it's still a world, and you still have an ego, and you can have the same emotions and so on. Better go beyond that. We should seek moksha. And this is what makes Hinduism particularly the only really valid religion. I don't mean that Christianity is not valid. I don't mean that Buddhism is not valid. But I say churchianity is not valid. And the Buddhist equivalent of churchianity is not valid because it's man's explanation of their teachings. Jesus taught one thing. His followers teach things that are very different. Jesus taught reincarnation, for example. You can see it in certain passages of the Bible if you're looking for it. But Christians say no. There's a very interesting book I've read also called Soul Survivor. And it was a boy of two who began having terrible nightmares. And he'd see himself going down in a plane. And what makes it particularly interesting is that it's the first American strong evidence of reincarnation there is. And what makes it strong is that as this boy grew up further, he began to remember that he had been a pilot in the Second World War, had been shot down and crashed into the sea near Iwo Jima, I think it was. And he remembered it so clearly because he'd been reborn within the time period that people who were living then, even then, were still living. And he had a wide association with people he knew, pilots and so on in the army, and he was able to meet these people. What happened was that his father was a very fundamentalist Christian and absolutely opposed to the idea of reincarnation and did his very best to disprove it. So any time this boy said something that indicated a memory, he would, instead of saying it can't be so, he'd go there, investigate it, and find out whether he couldn't disprove it. Finally ended up writing this book, and it's really quite it's a badly written book, but a very interesting one. Because this boy, finally he went to a big convention of pilots on that ship which he had been on, and he knew them all. And he said, but mother, they're so old. They were 50 or so. There's one man, the man came to him, he said, do you recognize me? He said, no, but I recognize you by your voice. He remembered the voice, but the man had grown old and had changed so much. I mean, these men now were in their 70s and 60s and so on. But it's a very interesting book. And what makes it such a very good book is that it's in a culture that basically doesn't believe in reincarnation and has exhaustively proved that this must be the answer. There's no other possible answer. This fundamentalist Christian finally was just completely convinced. But we do live in this world many, many times, and after we die, we go to that world. There have been many. There was an Ian Stevenson. He was a doctor in America, who researched many claims. Most of these claims did not come from America. They came from countries which believed in reincarnation, because the parents of a child who says, "I was so-and-so," they say, "Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah." They don't talk about it. But there was one case in Turkey where the child remembered having lived in another town not too far away. And he kept insisting, and his mother wouldn't take him, but he finally persuaded her, and he went there, and he led them right to their house. He recognized the people in the home. They knew their names. Everything checked out exactly. I think it was in this case, but it may have been another, where he remembered where he had left some hidden money, and they hadn't found it, so he went there and found it. There was one case in India of a girl called Shakuntala, and she remembered having lived in her life, and they went to where she had lived, and she saw some swans in a lake there, and she said, "You naughty creatures, you drowned me last time." And anyway, it's a fascinating story, but we are, for all that, as old as God. So how long have we been around? A long time. It says in the Bhagavad Gita that every time I throw this universe out, this creation out, another time into a Deha Brahma, I throw everybody out and they start the whole thing, they go through the whole thing again. And one can ask the question very easily, have I lived as long as a day of Brahma? Have I lived longer than a day of Brahma? If I've lived longer, how many days of Brahma have I lived? This is just begins to be a little frightening, doesn't it? To think that you had been wandering in delusion so long, each time thinking you'd finally got it together and you haven't got it together. It's not a happy thought. There was one sloka or verse in the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam. He was a Sufi, but a mystic. And he wrote the Rubaiyat, which Rubaiyat really means a quatrain. But the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam is well known as a love poem. But it wasn't a love poem. It was really a very deep thing. And most people think of Edward Fitzgerald's translation as just a love song. But my guru read it, and suddenly he saw the whole panorama. He understood everything. It was a very deep, mystical poem. And in this one of those quatrains said that many of those who came into creation when it first was manifested are still wandering at the end of this day of Brahma, which he didn't use the word Brahma, at the end of it. And they can go on and on. It's a bit frightening. But you, as long as you want this, this is where you have to be. It takes 5 to 12, I forget the figure right now, million lifetimes to reach the human level. Once you've reached that level, then the man can be, he has the free will to go up, but that free will helps him also to go down if he wants to go down. So you can progress and you can regress. And if you want to regress, you can become a Brahmin, can become a Shudra by his own nature. This is the trouble with the three gunas. When you develop sattva guna, you still have ego, and you don't yet find God, and you can fall from sattva guna. Just imagine how. Well, one quality of sattva guna is a state of peace. Well, from peace to laziness is unfortunately too close. You can fall from being very peaceful to being a Shudra and doing nothing. So you have to keep working until you finally get there. You can't be like the story of the hare and the tortoise. The hare raced, and finally when it reached the finishing line, it lay down and rested, and the tortoise finally crossed the finishing line while the hare was resting. So we have to realize that until we find God, we are not safe. My guru said to me, don't think you're safe until you have reached Nirvikalpa Samadhi. Even Sabikalpa, people can fall. He told us about Paul Brunton, and he said Paul Brunton fell. He was a disciple of Ramana Maharshi, and he reached a very high state. He reached Sabhikalpa. But as my guru put it, he couldn't forget he was English. And the brother of Ramana Maharshi was a martinet and telling everybody what to do, and he just couldn't take that, and he left his guru and so on. I believe I reached that state, at least Bhrigu said that. He said he achieved shanti in his vrittis, but I quarreled with my guru, so here I am still plodding around. So these things do happen. Everybody, we mustn't sit and rest until we pass the finishing line, until we get into nirvikalpa. When you reach nirvikalpa, then you have past memories that you still have to overcome. I as a pirate, I as a housekeeper, I as a restaurateur, I as all sorts of things. You have to, though you have that memory of having been all those things, and you have to go back through that memory and release it into the infinite. So that the way to release it is to realize that God acted that part. Once you see it was God doing it, you don't think, I did it. He is doing this life. He is acting through me now. And my memory of having done it on my own, I release that ego too into the infinite. And so when you've attained, when you've freed yourself from all those past memories, those past karmas, and a yogi can do it in one incarnation in vision. It's not as if you have to live that many lives to go to become free, not at all. In fact, I asked my guru, can't a person, once he's achieved nirvikalpa samadhi, can't he just say, I'm free and be free? And he said, yes, you can, but most don't want to. First of all, they don't care. They're already free. They're already one with God. It's just this little smoke they have to sort of blow out of the window. And so he says they often will use their past karma just as an excuse to come back to this world and help other people. So, yes, you can get rid of it, most don't. And once you attain complete freedom, then you go beyond, excuse me, then you go beyond even that memory, and you achieve from Jivan Mukti, you became a Siddha, or somebody who has attained moksha. Now, only in India has that concept of moksha been upheld. Not most Indians don't know about it, but it is there, and all the teachers of religion know it's there. In Christianity, Jesus taught about it, but Christians don't know about it. Christians think that you will spend your eternity in heaven, and I can't think of a worse hell than having to live in an ego for all eternity. And Buddhists, they say that you attain a state of nirvana. I read a pamphlet, an official pamphlet of Buddhism in Thailand in 1958, and it compared nirvana with Satchidananda, and it said that, well, yes, there is momentary bliss when you attain that state, but then nothingness. Honestly, I can't imagine anybody sincerely seeking nothingness. This is why Buddhists became atheists, because they thought that their master was an atheist. He wasn't. The only reason that he didn't talk about God was that he kept insisting, you have to do the work. And people were always thinking, God, you do it all. And so they did karmakand and got the gods to bless them with this and the other. So he was insisting on our part of it. That was his mission, that was necessary. But I have to say this, he was noted for his compassion. That compassion could not have come from nirvana. It had to come from something positive, not something negative. It can't have come from no consciousness at all. So he was certainly, he was an avatar, he was a great master, and he cannot have suddenly come up with a truth that contradicts the truth of all others. One thing you can see is that all true masters always teach the same things. They will give certain emphases according to the needs of the times, but the basic teaching is the same in all religions. And this is why when Western missionaries came to India, they saw how similar the Gita is to what Jesus was teaching. And they said, well, Krishna must have copied Jesus. Well, of course, Krishna lived long before Jesus. But they couldn't accept that. It had to be. It doesn't matter. Jesus didn't get it from Krishna. Truth is one. When you perceive it, you perceive the same thing. The thing is that you could go to Bombay, and if you're an architect, you'll come back and tell about the buildings. And people will think Bombay is nothing but buildings. But if you're a landscape architect or a gardener, you'll talk about the gardens. And if you come back and tell the same people about Bombay, you'll be giving a very different picture from the one that the other one told. But they're both seeing the same place. They're just emphasizing it differently, according to the needs of the times, according to their own temperament, whatever it may be. Anyway, the goal of Buddhism is the same. And so all great religions do teach that one thing. The only religion that knows that it teaches it, that is to say it's common knowledge, is Hinduism. And Hinduism is not that religion of Ganesha and Saraswati and Kali and so on. Sanatana Dharma is that religion which teaches that everything comes from God, everything is His dream, and everything must go back to God and become one with Him again. And this is the essence of Sanatana Dharma. And all the different ways of explaining it are just sort of explanations, but not the truth. The truth is always the same. So, this is, however, why Indians, you know, Yogananda made a startling statement one time. He said that there are no saints in the West as great as the greatest saints of India. He said because Indians have the technique. In the West, they don't have the technique. It's really only by their own devotion and seriousness. But with yoga, you can go much farther and much more quickly than if you don't know what you're doing and just have devotion. So when somebody came to my guru many years ago and told him he practiced bhakti yoga, but he hadn't found God yet, and my guru said to him, why don't you take Kriya Yoga? No, I have my own path, my own teaching. He said, this is not a separate teaching. It helps you to find success in your own teaching. No, he didn't want to take it. So my guru was trying to really urge him to take it because he saw he needed it. So he said, look, you've been in a room for 20 years. You've been trying to get out through the floor, the ceiling, the walls. I'm showing you where the door is. That's all. So the man took initiation, and within a week he had an experience of God. So the wonderful thing about yoga is that it shows you how you can get there. It shows you where the door is. And this teaching that India alone of all countries has preserved is a very priceless heritage. And really I want all of you to take it and help it to be known again, because in all ages you find the truth begins to become diminished and diluted, and these teachings have been diluted. Lahiri Maharaj brought back the original yoga, and Yogananda brought back the teachings of that original yoga, and those were their missions in this world. We can do a lot of good for this world if we can help Indians specifically, for example, to see that you won't have what you want if you copy the West. You have something to give. I was in the hospital. I had double pneumonia, and I could easily have died, but I didn't. And at least I would say, not necessarily fortunately. But anyway, I was hardly conscious, and the doctor came into my room. Well, you know what a doctor does when he comes into your room, especially if you're really ill. What can they do to help you? How are you? All these things. He came in, the first question he was, sir, can you help me? And I said, well, yeah, I can try. And he said, well, I have a son who's in college in Canada. I have many expenses, and I believe in yoga. But how can I be successful and meet all my responsibilities and be absolutely dharmic? And I said to him, I have had to build a large organization. I've had many people trying to tempt me to cut corners in dharma. And I said, I have been rigidly dharmic all my life. And the problem was that I couldn't be convincing because I was not advertisement for success, lying there practically unconscious. So the next day, Leela brought me my lunch. And I said, Leela, I must write a course on material success through yoga principles. And Keshava, who used to be my secretary, came in the afternoon to relieve her. And I said, Keshava, get some paper and a pen or a pencil. And I dictated the whole first, wasn't it the introduction? And then I thought, well, let's see if I can think of a few titles. I ended up thinking of all 26 titles. And it was to go out once every 2 weeks for a whole year. And then it took me a year and a half to write that course. And I thought that surely I'll have said everything as I get further into it. But the longer I went, the longer it was, the last courses, the last lessons, the longest of them all. But it's a very good course, and I know Dharmaraj here and others are working to help people to know. We call it now success and happiness through yoga. But I have to say that this is especially geared toward Indians, because Indians need to understand the need for dharma. People in India tend to think that business is here, religion is here. And if I'm in business, it doesn't matter if I tell lies, if it doesn't matter if I cut ethical corners. It does matter. And there is an ancient saying in India, yata dharma stata jaya. When you are dharmic, you will succeed. And many people don't understand this, but it is true. I've had many opportunities to cut corners. I've never done so. One time somebody came to me. I had to earn the money to start Ananda myself. I didn't have rich people backing me. My father never gave a penny to Ananda. And one day I'd gotten the land, I'd gotten our first buildings put up, and we really needed money to build further. And a young man came to me. He said, I have an inheritance, and I want to know, should I use my inheritance to come to Ananda, in which case I'd give that money to Ananda, or should I use it to go to India? Well, I wasn't even tempted, but I said to him, because I wanted to know if he had enough money to go to India, I said, how much money is it? He said, $200,000. Well, back in 1969, that was like saying $1 million today because of inflation. As I say, I wasn't even tempted. I said, I think you should go to India. Because if he had really wanted to come to Ananda, he would have said, I would like to come into Ananda. When he gave a choice, I thought, then that means he doesn't sincerely know whether he wants to be at Ananda, so I didn't want him. So I've been, many times I've had this problem. There was one time we had a forest fire. Living out there in the woods as we do, that's a great danger. And it destroyed 450 of our acres out of some 900. And 21 of our 22 homes just burned to the ground. And later it turned out that the fault was the cause of the fire was a faulty spark arrestor on a county vehicle. So it was a government thing. And our neighbors were all excited and they were saying we can sue them and get all our money back. And we were the biggest losers. So we could have gotten probably at least $2 million. It would have helped us to create Ananda. I wrote to the supervisors of the county and I said, I know that you're worried about us and whether we will sue. I said, I will not sue. We will take this bad luck out on ourselves. We don't want to take it out on our neighbors. We didn't have any fire insurance. We had to get all that money from our own efforts. Several people left the community in discouragement because after losing their homes, they felt they'd lost everything. We paid them back for their homes before we even began reconstructing our own homes. So I was very strictly dharmic, but although many people predicted failure for us, we came through. And again and again in my life, I have seen, I know that when SRF sued me, they wanted to destroy me. And they sued me, I think that they spent about $50 million in that attempt. Took them 12 years. But they hired the third largest legal firm in the world, Gibson, Dunn and Crutcher. I hired a sole practitioner who didn't even have a secretary, but I hired him because he was dharmic. And yet we won. We won everything except one little thing I was willing to give them just to get them off my backs so they could announce to the world we won. But they won less than 5%. We won 95% or more. So, but always I have done that which was the right thing to do. And I believe strongly in that statement. Yata dharma satta jaya. Well, unfortunately in India, in this time, I know that my guru talked about in the 19th century, a man would be willing rather to lose his home and everything rather than to tell a lie in court. More recently, when I was in SRF, I wrote a play and I wanted a dhoti because it was set in India. So I went to an Indian student and borrowed a dhoti from him. And he had a friend with him there. And the friend said, oh, I will definitely be there. Well, I knew he wouldn't be there. He hadn't asked where it would be, what it would be, when it would be. He hadn't asked anything. I knew he wouldn't come and he didn't come. That is something I have heard too often in India. I will definitely do something. When anybody in this country says definitely, I have doubts. I worry. This is something that has to be changed. I would like to get away. There's this tendency, it's an Eastern tendency in general, to tell people what you think they want you to say, what they want to hear. We must get away from that. I think that it's very important, and this course gives example after example after example of being dharmic and through that dharma finding success. So this is a good course. I would study it seriously. And still India does have things to learn. The West has things to learn. Ignorance is 50-50 everywhere in the world. People are just people. But we do find that there are times in history when this aspect of truth or that needs more emphasis. So, any more questions?
In this book, Master said he would reincarnate, has he?
Master said he would reincarnate, has he?
No, he said he would come back in 200 years. He said, in this life I have worked very hard, in my next life I will be alone for many years, and then after some years, I will come out and gather my people with me and we will retire to the Himalayas and be like Babaji and his So that was what he said. People have claimed to be he. It isn't so. These claims are not true. There are too many lies told this way. There's one man in Europe who was telling everybody, he was an Indian, telling everybody that he was reincarnation of Yogananda. Later it turned out that he was not scrupulous and people lost faith in him. But I said from the beginning, if he is Yogananda, why doesn't he come to see me? Why did he come to see his old disciples? Why doesn't he at least invite us to come see him? We haven't heard a word from him. There's something wrong there. So I know there is one person well known, unfortunately, an Indian Swami, who told everybody that he was a direct disciple of Sri Yukteswar. And I talked to Master's brother, Sanandan Lal, and Sanandan said, no, he wasn't. I myself recommended him to Bhanumangjiji. He never knew Sri Yukteswar. So don't take people's word for it. I say always test, as St. Paul said, test the spirits to see if they are of God or not. It's not enough to make a claim. You have to justify that. And you have every right to ask me too, anything you want to. Because you want genuine people. And Dharma is the answer. Okay, any other questions?
I lost my dad 2 years back. Is there any way that I know he is still in the astral world or whether he has taken a birth?
She lost father a few years ago, and has there any way to know whether he's still in the astral world or has taken physical birth?
You know, actually there is a way. Some psychics can help you to know. Some people are very psychic that way. But one thing you can do is pray very deeply. I know that when my father died, he had been very opposed to what I did. But when he died, suddenly I understood that same morning, I knew he was with me. And I felt him as he was when he was a young man. And a cousin of mine died, and I had an intense, vivid dream of her, and she too was the way she was when we were college students together. And so often departed people will come to you in dreams. Now whether he is reincarnated or not, I don't know, but this is something that certainly with a lot of intense devotion you can find out. I think that meeting somebody who has this particular ability, you can find it out that way too. Can I tell you? No, I don't know, so I can't tell you. Did you have a question?
Actually, this is something which
you
always wish to know.
What'd you
say?
This is something she's always wished to know.
Like what? Could be a reality for you, may not be right or something acceptable by others, maybe by the whole society.
What is real to you may not be acceptable to others or society.
Happens all the time. We
but
all have different realities.
Should you try to stand up to their expectations or do what is right for you?
Should you try to stand up to their expectations or do what is right for you?
Till the time you are fulfilling your responsibilities and you know that you are right or you are bound.
Until that time where you fulfill your responsibilities and know that you're right on your path.
You have to be true to yourself. You have to listen to them, you have to be honest with yourself in them. Don't just reject it out of hand. Listen to them, they may be right, you may be wrong. So your ego is not the right person to design. Many, for example, and I've used this example here on the television program, when people, a person, let us say, has very great talent as an actor, it still may not be his dharma to be an actor, because it may make him egotistical. So the worst thing for him to do would be to follow that talent. Sometimes your parents are wiser, sometimes they're not so wise. You should listen. Don't just automatically reject and say, I want what I want. Listen also. Be fair-minded. Those who love you will try to be thinking of what is for your welfare. I know that my parents wanted things for me that I knew was not right for me, so I had to go my way. But in other cases, well, your duty to society, your duty to your parents, your duty to yourself, all of these have to be gauged against your own soul desire to know God. If that desire is strong, and it's people like that that I usually talk, then sometimes you have to disappoint others. That I had to disappoint my father. I know that when, before I was born, my mother gave me to God, and she felt great bliss throughout her pregnancy, and I naturally have a debt to her, but what my father, I never had the same ideas. He was always interested in the whole of things. I remember a dusty expedition that he took us on under the house to show us how the front doorbell worked. Well, I tried to be interested, but I have to admit my real interest is in the why of things, not in the how. I remember one time we were standing on the terrace and looking at an apple tree, and there were sparrows in the tree. And he said, millions of years ago, the first creatures were in the sea. Then they were insects, then reptiles, then mammals, then man. He said, maybe millions of years ago, the leaders on the world will be the birds. They haven't had their turn yet. Maybe then it will be their turn. Well, I was five at the time, and I remember I was very intrigued at this idea of time being so long, so vast. But the thought of it coming to being the chief creature on this planet just because it's your turn didn't make any sense to me. I had to know why. And so we couldn't ever get together really in our understanding. Have I answered your question sufficiently? Because it wasn't sufficiently clear to me. What's she saying?
To some extent.
Can you help me further?
Actually, it's like, I'm not talking about the family in general. There's a society, you know, who always ask me questions. And you always tend to be clearer to your family, or just take that your family is not heard. But you cannot satisfy the whole society or keep answering the whole society all the time.
You might be able to explain yourself to your family and, you know, assuage their concerns, but to society you can't always answer all
Look,
their
if
questions.
You pay your taxes, I think your duty's done. I mean, really, what can you possibly do that will satisfy your whole society? The people who help society to advance are the people who don't work with what society wants. They have the new ideas. They're the ones who push in new directions. And Germany, for example. You know, I remember going through Germany in 1938, just before the Second World War. And the people were so kind to us. And I wonder, some of these Nazis, I suppose they were. But the Nazis suddenly told everybody how they had to be. Heil Hitler! There was one man in Berlin who stood up on the stage. He was a comedian, and he went like this, and everybody who was a Nazi stood up and went like this, and he said, that's how high my dog jumped yesterday. Well, they put him in prison, of course, but it says it needs some people with that kind of courage to stand up when there's this kind of of national mania that comes over countries. Don't let those people tell you, because it's always the lowest common denominator that decides for society what it should be. No, go your own way. You have no duty to such people. If you can give me an example that might disprove what I say, I'm open to it. I don't make any dogmatic statements, but this is the way I see it. Okay? Yes. At this lady first.
How do you connect to your guru who is not in a physical form anymore?
Well, he's with me. I feel his presence always. And I asked him one time, will you be as close to me as you are now, after you die? He said, to those who think me near, I will be near. I have found it to be so. So, okay. So you had another question?
When a soul reaches the level between causal and astral world.
When a soul reaches the level between the causal and astral birth or astral realm, world.
So
world.
It is said to that it can take any form of any human being or any creature that it wants to.
Such a soul can take any form of any human being or any creature that it wants to.
I'm not
How
quite sure what you're saying. Can you explain?
He's saying, is that correct, that if you are between the causal and astral worlds, in other words, you're no longer manifesting on Earth, can you take any physical form in those worlds, or manifested form in those worlds?
Well, you've left one manifested form. If you take a manifested form, you're in that world again. In the causal world, there's not manifestation of form, there's manifestation of states of consciousness. But there's still one particular form there, held together by the qualities that keep a person manifested ideationally. So that particular form can move about, but it's not visible in the normal way. So I don't quite understand this that you were saying.
Actually, it is said and it is written in like different books also, that when a person dies, then the soul crosses like 7 stages to reach the ultimate.
When a person dies, he goes through 7 stages to reach the ultimate freedom?
Well, Sri Teshwar narrowed it to 5. Of course, there are different levels in the astral world and so on. But we are 3 bodies. It's sort of like the ocean water is the spirit. It's encased in one body, which is the astral, the causal body. That's encased in an astral body. That's encased in a physical body. When the physical body is destroyed, you still have your astral body. When the astral body is destroyed, you still have your causal body. So when the beings that are free from earthly reincarnation are living permanently, might say, in the astral world, when they die, and they do die, they leave their physical form, their astral form, but there's still that causal body around them. So they still have that to deal with. Since I'm not there, I don't know what further to say, and I don't want to talk just theory.
Swamiji.
This gentleman raised his hand.
Swamiji, in the corporate world, we have goals to achieve, we have profits to achieve, we have targets which we have to see the results every day, every hour, motivate people or sometimes punish people. So how we relate it to Gita under these circumstances?
In the corporate world, we have goals and profits to achieve, we have to manage people, we have basically intense pressures and competition, but how can we then properly relate to the Gita and the spiritual teachings?
In my TV shows, I'm trying my best to show people how those teachings must be applied on this level. And I know that my guru's chief disciple, most advanced disciple, was a self-made millionaire, and he had lots of businesses, but he had to manage all of them. And he was so respected in his own sphere that he was on the board of directors of several companies. And when he was in the director meeting, nobody would smoke because they knew he didn't smoke. So he commanded respect. The thing is that what is the most priceless coin, you might say, in the business world is integrity. If somebody knows that what you say is true, he'll listen to you. If, for example, you come to a shop and they say, we don't have what you want, but there's a store down there that does have what you want, everybody will respect that salesman and feel that he at least he knows he's honest. He'll come back to that salesman because he knows he is honest. So when you are completely dharmic in the business world, yes, there's a lot of pressure, but if you hang on to that, you know, I've had, in my way, I've had to do those things myself because I've had to build a big community. We have 8 communities. We have about 1,000 people living there. We've had to earn our own way. We've had to have businesses, sub-businesses to support them. I've had to put people in different positions. I've never put anybody in a leadership who wanted it. I've wanted only people to lead who were willing to serve. And I found that, first of all, I've had my bottom line. Most people's bottom line is profit. My bottom line has been my inner peace. If anything disturbs my inner peace, I won't do it. I find that when I am peaceful, I can make good decisions. I know that if I were not peaceful, I would not make them. So if I feel that all the pressure of anything taking me away from that peace, then I just won't do it. We have another saying, people are more important than things. And if there is a thing that needs to be done, but it would not help anybody at Ananda to do it, then I'd rather not do it. So I always put the needs of people ahead of the project. This is one dharmic thing that you wouldn't normally find in a business. But I think that in this way, everybody knows that you're their friend, and so they work with you. A lot of the trouble in offices is, first of all, gossip. People don't work nearly as much as they think they do. They think they're under a lot of pressure, but it's pressure because this one writes a note and that one gets angry and this one is wondering whether he can't change jobs. All these little things keep coming up. Interpersonal problems are a major part of business, the business world. If you can learn a few principles for how to guide people, you'll find that, for instance, at Ananda, you almost never see even an argument. It's really quite amazing because it doesn't exist normally in the world. People support one another, they help one another. There are exceptions occasionally, very rarely. And so, yes, you can succeed in the business world and you can do it more successfully if you practice yoga. And that is what my whole course on success and happiness through yoga principles is all about. I really think it could help you to read that. It's the equivalent of a book of about 600 pages. There's a lot of information in it. But I know that it's difficult because in the beginning, if you haven't meditated, you haven't that habit, it's harder to get into a new thing when you're already in an old one. I think that several things could help. One is in the evening, say, I've done my duty to the world, now I'm going to do my duty by God. So don't be on the phone calling different people at night. Say, I'm finished with this. Give certain hours to God, and you'll find it easier then to focalize. Another thing would be to compartmentalize your life, as I was just saying, but more particularly, so that certain times in the day, if you're a boss, it's easier to handle. Certain times in the day you will do this, then this, then this. I was reading the life of Henry I of England, and he had a schedule in his court that in the morning, business, in the afternoon, play. And this kept the court always happy and well-balanced. These are, I could go into it in great depth if we were only talking on this subject, but in a general way, this is an answer that I can give you. Okay?
Yeah.
Any other? Somebody had a question?
Yeah. Swamiji, so we connect to our line of gurus. Is it right that we connect to our line of gurus through you? Suppose we want to connect to Yukteswarji or...
If you pray to them, you will find that when you pray to Sri Yukteswarji, you get his particular consciousness.
Okay.
It will be he specifically who comes. And I have found sometimes when I pray to Babaji that I get special help from him. and so on. Yeah.
Swamiji, yes. There are many people nowadays, even I have met someone in Lucknow, and he claims to have met Babaji and got initiated by Babaji. So, how far?
He has met someone in Lucknow who claims to have met Babaji and been initiated by Babaji.
Well, it may be true, and if it isn't, but if it is, I'd love to meet him.
But he was smoking and
this man was smoking and drinking and doing other such things.
There was somebody in Mumbai, I think it was, who claimed to have seen Babaji, and he had a smoke with him and so on. I don't believe that nonsense. It just has to be nonsense. It doesn't make sense. You hear many lies, and you have to sift through them. And there have to be certain things that you take as signs. If they are really self-controlled, if they have bliss, if they are very truthful and so on, even truthful people can be self-deluded. So don't just accept because somebody tells you this. There are an awful lot of myths out there.
God is an infinite intelligence.
God is an infinite intelligence.
If I always try to connect with Him.
If I always try to connect with Him.
If we have a guru in physical form, we always have His picture in imagination.
If we have a guru in a physical form, we have His picture in our imagination.
But we have not seen God. It's an infinite intelligence. If I always try to connect Him, how should I? I always try to talk with God. Whatever I do, I always keep myself in touch with God. But I don't have any physical form, so I just see the Om sign. I always in 24 hours, whenever I awake, I always connect with God.
I heard most of it, but tell me.
But we don't have an image of God. And so he's using the Om sign to focus on God. And
God is a source of light. So what I try to do is that I always try to connect with the source of light.
If you think of God in the impersonal way, a very good thing to do is to memorize Master's poem Samadhi and repeat that every day. The problem is that we are human beings. As a result, we know consciousness as it expressed, as it is expressed in other human beings. And even the Muslims, who rigidly exclude all forms, Guru Nanak said to them, but you still have that black stone in Mecca. People, as human beings, need something to focus on. It's hard to focus on something that's everywhere. So it does help to keep an image of the Guru or to think of God as the Divine Mother. I remember one time somebody wrote Master a note saying, when I think of you, when I see you, I see the Divine Mother. And all Master said was, then behave accordingly. It really is God. And God has many different forms. This is why in India they don't have idol worship. They have ideal worship. That's very different. And God is, when you see a form, visualize a form, see in the eyes of that form infinity. So don't ever feel that this is God. God is the infinite ocean. This is a problem that every devotee has to face. It's not so easy. One time Master was standing as close to me as you are, and I was in my mind thinking, he's not just in that body, he's everywhere. He's here. And at that moment Master with an impish smile came over and gave me an apple. And I think he was playing. But he wanted me to know that he's both human and not human. So that I was wrong to try to exclude him from that. And I was having the same problem you're mentioning. How can he be both? It's difficult to understand. But in fact, God, I think there is a certain human aspect to God that we don't even somehow understand. I'm still thinking through this thing myself, so.
When I see towards the sky, it's very big. So I think of it as a God. God is very big. So I just think up, I just see up and I think, yeah, God is there, okay. I talk to God in that way.
Yes, it's hard to think of just the sky. But this is why Krishna is blue, representing the sky. representing Christ consciousness. He wasn't really blue. But we can't live without symbols. Words are symbols. I say words are symbols. Each one of those is a symbol. And in another language, it would have perhaps a slightly different shade of meaning. I don't know. I speak some 9 languages. Don't only one well, and don't ask me which one. But it's very interesting to see how differently people think, are forced to think, by their language. In Bengali, they say, Amar kide peche, right? Where is he?
I am hungry.
This is a land which speaks of renunciation as the idea. Why do they have to keep saying Amar, my this, my that? Amar kide peche, I'm hungry. My hunger has got, literally. Well, that sounds like it's sort of excessively possessive. It's not my hunger, it's just hunger. Anyway, language forces you to think in certain ways. Any other questions?
There are times of days when you're very tired. Kriya needs to be done sitting straight and erect. Your spine should be erect so energy can flow upwards. But there are times of days when after a hard day's work you're very tired and you're lying down. Is this specifically we can do anything? Would meditation work if you try and do it?
Can you meditate, if you're very tired at night, can you meditate or even do Kriya or anything while lying down?
You can. Lie flat on your back. And the Master said that sometimes in a group of people, you can lie down and they'll think, pretend that you're sleeping, so they won't disturb you and just do Hong So. So, yeah.
This is about the days of Brahma and nights of Brahma you spoke about. Some traditions say that after many days and nights of Brahma, there's a total dissolution of all the karmas and all, everything, all the egos that are there. Have you heard of such, or is that true?
No, it doesn't seem to work that way. It would be nice if it did. You'll have to slog your way through it until you get out. But this is to be remembered too. Dr. Lewis one time said, well, Master, I have a doubt. When I get, if I get liberation in this day of Brahma, in the next day of Brahma, will I have to go through it all again? He said, no, once you're free forever. So, but no, you have to do the work to get there yourself. It won't be handed to you on a silver platter.
Swami, I'm sorry, I have to go back to this gentleman's question about doing Kriya laying down, because we get that question a lot in class.
Well, it's better not to, but still you can do it that way.
Okay.
Yeah. No, that's not the ideal position. Because the thing is that you're lying down, you've practiced being unconscious or subconscious when you're lying down. So it's not saying, well, do it either sitting up or lying down. Do it sitting up. But if you need to lie down because of maybe physical pain, maybe exhaustion, maybe the other reason I gave, you can do it, but it's a weak alternative. Okay?
If I'm in bad pain, how do I concentrate and stay balanced?
One thing that I've found is thinking of myself as not only here, but spread out over the territory around me. So that this pain is only a part of my little reality, of my greater reality. So try to withdraw from the pain and find a greater reality. I've had this experience in the dentist chair, where the dentist was drilling or doing a lot of hard work on me. And I would just take my mind away from that and compose music or work out some paragraph of a book I was writing or something like that. Have my mind on something else. In China, they have a technique, or probably don't anymore, but used to have. I remember I did go to a Chinese dentist in Calcutta many years ago, and he didn't follow this method. Anyway, the classical method was when extracting a tooth, hit somebody on the toe with a mallet. And you don't know where to feel pain. But I find that the most important thing is try to withdraw the energy from that and direct it elsewhere, direct it up, into a larger area. And so if I hear it's harder because it's right up near your brain, but I try just to withdraw from that and just say it's not real. I never take Novocaine, and I find that I can do it. It's one way. Gandhi had his appendix out without taking anesthesia. I don't know if I could do it or not because I wouldn't dare try. But he did. So actually there's no nerves in the intestine, so it would have been mental, but it would have been melted, so it's mental. You have to accept the realities as you perceive them.
Can we add, sir, just to that question, what about emotional pain?
Emotional pain, there are many things. All of them have to be directed toward redirecting your focus. In emotional pain, you think of this particular thing. Try to feel that in time, in a few days, in a week, in a month, in a year, you'll be on to other problems. Don't let it be, don't let the present be your whole reality. Feel that you're in space and time. The emotional pain of bereavement, of betrayal, so many pains we go through. But if we can learn to be even-minded and cheerful, then those little waves don't have much impact on us. So when you watch Indian TV, which I don't, but I've seen sometimes women terribly, absolutely destroyed because somebody didn't bring their butter for their toast or whatever. And if they could learn to be calm, there wouldn't be anything to get excited about. So I think the main thing is to be even-minded and cheerful. When you are completely calm, if you can center yourself in your heart and feel joy there, actually you can feel joy under all circumstances. But the main thing is be centered in calmness. From that calmness, you can focus on whatever you want, whatever kind of state of mind you want. But if you're caught by that thing, then there's no way out. You'll have to withdraw from that to your own inner self, and then simply send that self here or there, as I've done with dental work, but it's in all ways of life, it's valid. Okay? You had a question?
Yes. So could you describe your experience of God?
Could you describe your experience of God?
Well, my experience of God is basically that I feel His bliss. I am not... I know my guru. He told me that in past lives I was full of doubt. And when I was in India in the time of Kurukshetra, I left my guru because I was full of doubt. He said that you have been full of doubt many lifetimes. So he said, in this life, the time, these things are being hidden from you. And I've been deeply envious of people who have such easy experiences. They don't come to me. But at least I can say I feel bliss. So I have to say that when He wants it, He will give me what He wants to give me. I don't worry about it. We have to have nishkam karma, even as relates to our own meditation. But I would like to say to you, I go into samadhi, I see the masters, I see this brilliant light and go into the astral world. None of it. I just think, here I've been on the path 61 years and I don't even have that. And sometimes I feel like I must be a complete dud. But then I know that I do feel this bliss, and that's what it's all about. So sometimes I can hardly stand it, I feel so much bliss. So what else really matters in comparison to that? But I would love to say, oh, I've seen you in vision, I've seen Babaji. I must be a complete dud, as I've said. Okay? Any other questions? Yeah.
Could you tell us about subconscious mind program?
Subconscious mind?
Subconscious.
Oh, could you tell us about subconscious mind programming or reprogramming?
When you go to sleep at night or when you wake up in the morning are the best times because the subconscious is more open then. So have a strong affirmation of what you want to develop. You know the expression that when a person wakes up grumpy, they say he must have gotten up on the wrong side of bed. At least that's an expression in the West, I don't know, or in America, I don't know if they have it in India. But the basis of it is that the attitude with which you wake up sort of determines your whole day. And that is because you came from the subconscious, and the subconscious is open to that suggestion, which then guides you through the whole day. And if you've woken up or had a cheerful thought as you woke up, it influences your whole consciousness. So it's a good to use your subconscious helpfully. The subconscious is a great liar, so don't trust it too far. You've got to bring it to heel, like a dog. Yes, what were you saying?
So yesterday you were telling that alcoholic, when he dies in the next life, you know, he will have that consciousness of alcoholic. And
an alcoholic who dies in his next life will have that consciousness of an alcoholic?
Yes.
And just one drink can tip him towards alcoholism. So I have an addiction of excessive thinking.
He said, like an alcoholic, he is saying he himself has an addiction of excessive thinking.
Would that mean that I have, every lifetime I
does that
have
mean
the
he's done that?
You know, why Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita has the monkey emblem? Because the monkey represents the restless mind. And everybody is the restless mind. If you're more intellectual, think more. But everybody's that way. We have to gradually calm the mind. And you even wonder, why did Patanjali give the definition of yoga as stilling the vortices, the whirlpools of feeling, when it's the mind that gets confused and thinks a lot? But indeed, when the feeling becomes calm, then the mind becomes calm. So to calm the mind, concentrate more on calming the feelings. Then you reach that stage where what actually happens in deep meditation is that you're fixed, you can't think. The mind is held firm. So, well, it is 12:15. Do you want to go on, or?
Swamiji, how to experience Atman?
How to experience the Atman?
The Atman is the Self. The Self is you. The ego is asking the question. The Self is asking that question through the ego. But the ego is the restless outer part. This ego is the soul identified with the body.
Did you say Atman? I'm sorry, Atman.
Which?
Atman.
Atman. The soul.
Okay, that's a good one.
So, did I answer that, or what did he say beyond that?
So, how to...
Well, all sadhana is to take you out of that. I mean, so shall I repeat everything I've said today? And beyond that, read you the Bhagavad Gita, and then the Vedas, then the Upanishads, and it's all geared toward that. So what we need to do, because there are many, many paths, we need to decide which is our path. And I always tell people, I don't try to convert anybody. I don't believe in conversion, except to people's own higher self. And so people ask, do I belong on this path? I usually say, try it and see for yourself. I'm not going to tell you. You have to decide. If it's satisfying, fine. If it isn't, find some other. But there are many paths to God, and many paths work. I am not interested in the path of Ramana Maharshi, but I know it's a true path. I'm not interested in other gurus, but I know there, many of them are very true gurus. But I have my own guru, and I've given my life to that. You can't follow several paths at once. Follow one path, otherwise you get confused. You have your feet in two boats. When the boats separate, you flop in the middle and may be drowned. Okay? Well, I think that's enough for today, but I'm so happy that you all came. I hope to see you soon up in Gurgaon. When am I going there? Near, where's Leela?
26th,
Swamiji.
The 26th.
I go up there. I have a lecture here the 25th, and I go up 26th. Right?
Yeah.
Okay. And I'm... Yeah, yeah. Okay, so I'll be there the 26th of April. I'll be there for how long?
1 week.
Oh, there you are, Miriam. 1 week. So I'll be there for 1 week. And I think I'm giving a talk there, am I not? Diana, you know?
It would be wonderful, but there's nothing scheduled at this point.
Well, I'm willing to, so put it that way. Okay. Thank you all. Shigir Das Kahobe. Sangeeta?
Yes.
Look at this and see. I was going to read you. Would you like to just say and hear a few of these?
Yes.
Okay, I'll read you a little bit from this new book. When giving a gift, think not only whether it is something your friend would enjoy receiving, think also whether you would enjoy giving it to him. Gifts should carry vibrations of love and happiness. To give someone a painting that he likes, but that you yourself abominate, would deprive the giving of its essential ingredient, joy. Pretend to yourself that this day is the beginning of a new incarnation. Obviously you aren't a newborn babe, but try to wipe out any power the past has to keep you always doing the same things, making the same mistakes, and performing the same old ways. Look for new things to accomplish, new worlds to conquer, new ideas to express. Don't be the kind of person who declares pompously, "Well, as I always say." Don't be a psychological antique. Try to be ever new in yourself and in your relations with friends, loved ones, and even complete strangers. So, what more? When your problems view your problems dispassionately, as if from a mountain peak, perspective is lost in the valley of personal involvement. How tiny life's problems are compared to your spiritual reality. If you allow them to loom large, they may overwhelm you, but if you view them dispassionately, you will see them merely as little specks on a vast panorama of life. Be grateful always to light, to others, to life, to God. Express appreciation for everything, appreciation and gratitude, even for such tests as suffering, will attract to you the blessing of increasing abundance. Sow seeds of faith where others have sown doubt. Don't ask more of others than you would ask of yourself. There are two kinds of innocence, that of ignorance and that of wisdom. A little girl asked once by a little boy, "Are you a virgin?" replied, "No, not yet." Hers was the innocence of ignorance. Such innocence may in time be undermined. The innocence of wisdom, however, follows upon complete conquest of ego. Such innocence, though childlike, can never be undone. Its strength, though flexible, is indomitable. Listen to the melodies birds sing. They express a happiness that is latent everywhere in nature. Reflect then, you too are a part of that happiness. It is the first little chip of omnipresent joy. And so on.
Send a blessing for you for your shows upcoming this week. And
oh, I'm always happy to have blessings. Sure.
An appreciation from all of us. Let's visualize Swamiji in the great light of all the masters, uplifting him in body, mind, and spirit. May he feel our divine love and appreciation for all he's given us in our lives. Let's rub our hands together and chant Om 3 times.
Your blessings.